Support for this podcast comes from San Francisco International Airport. At SFO, you can discover award-winning flavors and unique shops all before takeoff. Learn more about what's at SFO at flysfo.com.
Hey, it's Avery Trufelman, host of Articles of Interest. And I've got to say, I've been a fan of KQED ever since I was a little kid, and I would come out to San Francisco to visit my grandma. It was just what we'd always turn on every time we got in the car, every time we were making dinner and turning on the radio. It was always KQED. And then over the years, I've become a massive fan of KQED podcasts because this is local reporting at its best. These are answers to questions you've always wanted to know, interviews with exciting, unusual voices, necessary journalism, all told with love and care and artistry. And did you know that a majority of KQED's funding actually comes from members? It's just people like you and me supporting the programs they love, while also getting access to cool events, behind-the-scenes footage, and so much more. If you want to sign up and be a part of this amazing community, visit donate.kqed.org/podcasts to become a member today. That's podcasts with an S. Thank you for listening, and thank you for your support.
From KQED.
Hey there, everybody. It is that time again. From KQED Public Radio, this is Political Breakdown. I'm Scott Schaefer.
And I'm Guy Marzorati, in this week for Marisa Lagos. And today on The Breakdown, one of 21 candidates running for the Democratic nomination for president, Washington State Governor Jay Inslee, and he's making climate change the cornerstone of his campaign.
He definitely is, and he'll be joining us in just a few minutes. But first, Guy, some fireworks in Washington this week. U.S. Attorney General William Barr testified, of course, before the Judiciary Committee of the U.S. Senate, which happens to include both California Senators Dianne Feinstein, the senior member, and Kamala Harris, actually the junior member, the first and last of the Democrats to talk.
That's right. She hits 10th, but we'll be talking about her first today. As we often have on the show, look, these moments of questioning when Kamala Harris gets to take on Trump officials or different people testifying in both the Senate Intelligence and Senate Judiciary Committee, this is when she is in her proverbial bag, her zone, her element. This is when she gets to show off the kind of prosecutorial skills that I think she's largely basing her presidential campaign on.
She is. And, of course, she got a lot of headlines for her sharp questioning, I think you could say. Very methodical, A, B, C, D. One thing leads to the next. And as you said, it's her experience as a prosecutor, which she is quick to point out. I want to play a little clip from a portion of that questioning where she is asking William Barr, the attorney general, about whether or not President Trump's been involved in the Department of Justice.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Attorney General Barr, has the president or anyone at the White House ever asked or suggested that you open an investigation of anyone?
I wouldn't.
Yes or no?
Could you repeat that question?
I will repeat it. Yeah. Has the president or anyone at the White House ever asked or suggested that you open an investigation of anyone? Yes or no, please, sir.
The president or anybody else.
Seems you would remember something like that and be able to tell us.
Yeah, you can just kind of hear him burning up the clock there, right, trying to run down the clock. Of course, he was under oath, so he was being careful not to lie, I guess you'd say. But there's been a lot of talk that the president has, in fact, been encouraging the Department of Justice to look into, for example, Hillary Clinton.
But I think it was notable that running out the clock was not what Harris was trying to do. And that's kind of stands in contrast. There's two other senators on that panel, Cory Booker, Amy Klobuchar, also running for president, who started out, you only get 7 or so minutes, and they both started out their time really with these stem whining summaries of how they thought Barr has handled Mueller's report. Harris, the clip that we played, that was how she started. She went right into the questioning. And I think, you know, it's a lot of talk about 7 minutes of time. I think we have to take a step back. Why does this matter? I think in a field where you're in a field of 20 or 21 candidates, there's only so many singular moments that you get. This is a solo, basically.
You got to make the most of it.
The entire political world is watching this. This is your chance to kind of make a viral moment. And I think it is kind of a good precursor, as we're now less than 2 months away from debates. You're going to be on stage with 10 other candidates.
I would push back, though, because I know there's a lot of the talk is, oh, this really shows she could go toe-to-toe with President Trump on the debate stage. And we will see. Perhaps it does. But first she's got to get through 20 or so Democrats. And I'm not sure that it is the same skill, that it does translate, but to, you know, maybe
right. I would say, you know, I don't think the general election debates, and honestly, I think in a general election, by the time the debates come around in September, people have made up their mind. I'm thinking more in a primary stage. You're there with 10 other candidates, and you really are looking to create a viral moment, a moment where even people who are not watching live will be rewatching on their Twitter feeds and Facebook feeds, you know, for days to come. I think she's honed in on that and an ability to kind of a quick strike moment, which could come in handy if she's going against 20 other people over the course of two nights.
Well, especially Joe Biden, I think, because Biden, although he's had a really good week, a big bounce in the polls from his announcement that he's running, you know, I don't know that his strength is going to be quick pivoting and parrying of topics on a debate stage. I mean, he has a lot of other strengths, but I'm not sure that is going to be one of them. And I think you have to give Kamala Harris particular credit because she is the junior senator on that committee, and she went last. Some of these other folks, Klobuchar, Cory Booker, they had a little more time to think about how they were going to make their mark, how they were going to, you know, make some news perhaps. And the fact that she did go last and made the most of it, you know, I think that says a lot for her. And she's tried to capitalize it, as they all have, with fundraising pitch. Which is right after
pre-written email.
Yeah, yeah. All right, we're going to take a short break, and when we come back, our conversation with Washington State Governor and presidential candidate Jay Inslee. You're listening to Political Breakdown from KQED Public Radio.
Hi, I'm Sasha Coca, host of the California Report magazine. Every week, we bring you stories about what connects us in the giant, diverse Golden State. Because what happens in California changes the world.
I love this place. We were once seen as, like, the place to be, California. The land of milk and honey. That's where you go to Sunshine State. But we just have challenges right now.
KQED's California Report magazine. New episodes drop every Friday, wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey there, this is Brittany Luce from NPR's It's Been a Minute. KQED's podcasts like The Bay, Bay Curious, Mind Shift, Right Nowish, and more all tell the stories of the Bay and beyond with reliable, human-centered journalism. They aim to inspire, make you think, entertain, and expand your understanding of the place you call home. Here's how you can support podcasting at KQED.
Showing your support is easy, and you can join Brittany in supporting KQED Podcast too at donate.kqed.org/podcast. That's donate.kqed.org/podcast.
Welcome back to Political Breakdown. I'm Scott Schaefer, and we're here with Guy Marzorati and our guest, Washington State Governor Jay Inslee. Governor Inslee, welcome to Political Breakdown.
Thank you for this is the center of Western civilization, so thanks for having me.
Well, as long as you're here, it is. We'll say that. So listen, let's talk about your early years. You grew up in Washington State. Your dad, I think, was a biology teacher. Talk about the impact of growing up in a place like that and how it affects the way you think today about the outdoors and obviously the environment.
Well, I was really fortunate. My dad was a coach, biology teacher. My mom and dad worked on the slopes of Mount Rainier in the summers, helping fix the alpine meadows and helping people in a group called the Student Conservation Association. So I grew up surrounded by, you know, ideas about biology and forest meadows to revegetate and forests to hike in and, you know, and places to kayak and clam and crab. And it was a great place to grow up. And I carry those memories now as governor because I'm very engaged in trying to make sure that my grandchildren have the same opportunities that I do. And the reality is that they will not. They will not have forest hiking because they're burning down. They will not have snow to ski on because the snow level going up. They're not having shellfish to catch because we can't grow baby oysters right now because of the ocean acidification. So this is a heritage that I enjoyed, and I'm committed to fight for my grandchildren. It's one of the reasons I'm running for president.
Now, did I read that your dad taught Jimi Hendrix? Is that a true story?
We don't know for sure. He taught at Garfield High School. We're not positive yet. We've never done the records research. But I know he did not teach him chemistry.
I think he would have been more of a chemistry guy than biology.
My dad was a biology teacher.
He didn't teach him guitar, I don't think.
No, he did not teach him left-handed guitar. But my dad was a very well-loved teacher and coach. And I'll tell you, one of the joys of governor is I get to meet his former students and come up and tell me what a difference he made in their lives. And I can't tell you how many times I've had people say, look, your dad really turned me around. And that's one of the reasons I'm so committed to educators right now. That's one of the reasons I fought and get the biggest pay increase I've had for a long time. So his memory is important in my life.
You were quite an athlete when you were young. I think you were the starting quarterback, state champion in basketball. Did you have any interest in politics at that time, or is it all kind of focused more on sports?
No, I don't remember. I was focusing on basketball and then Trudy Tyndall, now my wife of 46 years at the time. So those were my two things I focused on. I will have to argue with you about being a star, though. I was hardly a star. In fact, I'm the only person in American history to have a 7-point scoring average and have my jersey retired at my high school. So I had to be elected governor to get that happen.
So between football and basketball, did you have, like, which was your real passion?
Basketball has been my passion in older times where I've, played till I was in my early 60s and got to play a vigorous game against Barack Obama at the White House. And he still complains about me, accusing me of fouling him once. But,
He called you a hack.
He called me a hack, and he did so at an event in front of about 2,000 people. And I had to tell him afterwards, I said, that was pretty rough on me, Mr. President. And let me just tell you that you can go ahead and trash talk me all you want anytime you raise me $1 million for my campaign. So it was acceptable. He's a good baller. I respect his game.
So after high school, you actually came down here just a few miles from where we are today, went to Stanford for a year. What happened there? Why did you leave after a year?
Well, I love Stanford. It was a great year. It was a very tumultuous year. It was Cambodia Spring, and there was a lot of unrest, and the Vietnam War was certainly a powerful issue. So it was quite a year, but I did not win the scholarship that I hoped to have won. I played freshman basketball, and the coach correctly assessed my talents and freed me not to be in the varsity. So I went back up to the University of Washington. I essentially could not afford a Stanford education, but I did love it. Had a wonderful, and I still have a lot of friends from that time. But I went up to the University of Washington, majored in economics, studied energy usage, went to Stockholm, Sweden, to the first international conference on the environment. And that sort of began my effort and interest in clean energy. And I've followed up now as being the candidate for president to help tame climate change. And that started my interest in that, was in that research project we did back in 1972. So all is well. I'm fully employed and back at the Stanford community.
So then from college, you went to law school, eventually moved to Central Washington. So you were from the Seattle area, the west side of the state. What was life like moving, living in Central Washington?
I loved living in the Yakima Valley. It's an area where some of the best apples in the world comes from. Trudy and I raised our three boys there. We lived in an old farmhouse. I grew alfalfa on the side. And it was an ideal experience. We got involved in public life, trying to pass a school bond, and we passed it after six failures. We passed it on the seventh try. And shortly thereafter, the legislature changed the funding formula and cut our money about in half. And I got angry about this whole thing, and so I ran for the legislature and went to the legislature, and ever since I've been working on educational issues and early childhood educations and education issues. Some of the things I started then, we now are advancing as governor with huge increases in early child education, huge increases in school funding. So what I started in the Yakima Valley, I'm now finishing as governor.
So you were living and got elected, I think, to the state legislature from a more conservative area?
Yeah, I was in a very conservative area, about a 63% Republican district, and I got elected because I was focused on education. And then I went to Congress in 1992, and then in 1994, we had a vote where we needed just a couple of votes to pass the assault weapon bill. And I believe that was the right thing for the country. And I also knew if I voted for it, there was a probability that I would not retain my seat. But I felt then, and I felt now, that it was an obligation to follow my convictions. And I felt that no child's life was, less important than any congressman's seat. So I voted for the assault weapon bill. It was one of the pivotal votes. It passed. And I was not reelected. But I have never for one second I regretted that vote. It was the right vote then. It is now. And I'm pleased now as governor I've led and we've had three major advances in common sense gun legislation.
What What was that process like, getting to a yes vote? Because there were some reports that you were undecided just on the day, I think, of the vote. Was it that fear, the political fear, or did you have any questions about the bill itself?
Well, look, when you pick up your family and you move 2,500 miles and you change your kids from the school they're in and you have such disruption in your life, and you're doing something you really believe in, which was serving the United States in Congress. And I was doing a really good job because we made some real progress on water issues for my community, passed the Yakima River Bill, it was really important. Worked on some issues to get our apples into Japan very successfully. But when you have a realization that one vote may end your political career, you do give thought to that, and I did. But I realized that on something that is of a life and death issue, which we now experience continually, and including in our mosques and our temples, as we have so recently in our country, that this was clearly the right vote. It was a vote of deep conviction.
You know, in those days representing a conservative district, I'm wondering, were there positions you took or, you know, votes that you took where looking back, you felt like, you know, I may regret that. I may have done it representing this specific area, but now holding an office representing an entire state, maybe now running in a Democratic primary, I regret that vote.
Well, look, I don't run my life looking backwards first. I don't look in the rearview mirror, so I don't spend a lot of time doing that. But I do believe I felt I followed my convictions. There are votes that I would have cast differently today. One was for the crime bill, for instance, that if I'd known then what I know now about how it would affect particularly minority communities, I would not have cast that vote had I known that. But that's the lessons of history that we all should learn. And if you don't learn from history, you're not paying attention.
When you got reelected to Congress, it was a different district. You moved more to the Seattle area. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Was that, you know, what? Why did you decide to move? Was that sort of thinking, well, did you want to get back to Congress and thought maybe that was more friendly territory, or was it more complicated than that?
We decided to go back to the west side of the state. You know, our families were getting a little older, and being closer to our parents was kind of handy. And our kids had already sort of moved, so they were ready for the next adventure. Felt right, so we went back to Bainbridge Island, a beautiful little island, and it's just a gorgeous place to live, and so I've been happy, and we've been there ever since.
And you resigned that seat to run for governor in 2012.
Yeah, I got elected in 1998, again, running on environmental issues and running on gun safety issues, and I was one of only two members of Congress that defeated incumbents, Republican incumbents. I ran as an underdog. There's been a theme throughout my career that I've started almost always as an underdog. And then in 2012, started 16 points behind, but beat a sitting attorney general and ran on climate change at that time. I was maybe the first person to win a governor's race running on an issue that we needed to build a clean energy economy.
So that strategy of I'm giving up the seat that I have, I'm going all in for the race that I want. In that case, it was the governor's race. What's kind of the strategy, the thinking behind that? I mean, it's not a step you're taking in this race. You know, what kind of went through your decision-making not having that safety valve?
Well, I thought it was achievable that, you know, you're one of 435 when you're in the House. You're one of one when you're governor. So I'm maintaining my responsibilities, and very effectively, I believe. We just finished what I think was, in my view, one of, if not the most effective legislative session in state history, where we've passed a 100% clean electricity bill. We've passed the best energy efficiency bill in America's history, with the first requirement for retrofitting commercial buildings. We've passed the first long-term care bill. We've passed the first public option. We've done a lot of really good things in the last couple of months.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Political Breakdown. I'm Scott Schaefer, here with Guy Marzorati, and our guest this week is Washington State Governor Jay Inslee. He's running for president in the Democratic primary. Climate change is really the raison d'etre of your campaign. That is what you're focusing on.
I don't speak French, but
I don't either, and I'm sure
good.
I mispronounced that.
It sounds
that.
Very classical to me.
I speak Spanish, not French, so much. But anyway, why do you risk being sort of a one-note candidate? Or on the other side, do you feel you need to do something more quote-unquote out there to distinguish yourself? Because, you know, all the Democrats running for president are talking about climate change.
Three answers to that. Number one, look, climate change is not one issue. It's all the issues. It's all the issues wrapped into one package. Because no matter what you care about in America, we can't solve your problem or advance your aspirations unless we solve climate change. Look, if the economy is your number one, we're having massive economic damages to our communities right now. You know, you've had a bankruptcy of your utility. You had 25,000 people have their homes burned down. You have $1.5 billion of damage in the Midwest from the floods. Enormous infrastructure damage in Miami, all across America. This is an economic issue. Look, the course of inaction, people say, does it cost too much to fight climate change? No, it costs way too much not to fight climate change and beat it, number one. It's a job creation opportunity on the positive side like crazy. It's a healthcare issue all across America. Look, I remember talking to a couple in New Hampshire a couple weeks ago. Their daughter lost 2 years in college because of Lyme disease, right? Lyme disease is a tough disease, and it's moving north because ticks are moving north. If you care about national security, this is a national security issue that might be one of the top national security threats of the United States. The Pentagon has issued repeated warnings to the president that this is going to cause more droughts, it's going to cause more mass migrations, it's going to cause more political instability. We have climate change refugees today on our border from Guatemala right today. So this is all of the issues wrapped up in one, and we have to solve it to solve the other issues.
You are one of your opponents in this race, if that's what you want to call them, is Beto O'Rourke, a former El Paso congressman. He put out an environmental policy platform this week, and you were pretty quick to slap him down and say, why did you cast these sort of pro-oil industry votes when you were in the House of Representatives? I mean, do you feel like part of being the climate change candidate is part of that, to call out others?
The regulator.
The regulator. to call people out when they're inconsistent, shall we say, or hypocritical.
Well, I would think, a better ambition is to inspire people to raise their game. And I hope that my candidacy is having that impact. I welcome anybody to come up with ideas, but I do believe that the urgency of this, together with the massive undertaking it is to develop a real mobilization of the American economy, demands someone with my experience and my passion, not somebody who might have thought of this recently because it has some nice political overtones now, but this is a massive undertaking that requires enormous political capital and enormous commitment. And I have that. Look, there's no question about this for people who know me. I helped establish the U.S. Climate Alliance with Jerry Brown and Andrew Cuomo in 2016. I've introduced some of the first legislation in 2003. I now have advanced some of the most leading aggressive climate change legislation in America. I'm moving the needle, not as a bumper sticker, but as actual reality. So I'm happy to inspire others to join me in this regard, and I'll be happy to have that discussion.
Well, I was going to say, you wrote a book more than 10 years ago, I think, talking about economic mobilization in the face of climate change. The Green New Deal comes along. I don't know if you've reached out to AOC for royalties or anything like that. But, how can you explain kind of the way that the Green New Deal captured people's imaginations and got people talking about climate change in a way that really hadn't happened before? What do you attribute that to?
Well, I think the people, look, Ed Markey was involved that with well, and Ed and I worked on the climate change legislation in 2009. So look, hats off to people who got people talking about climate change. I think it's wonderful. I think it's a combination of a little panache and good timing. The timing is important because 2007, when I wrote my book, climate change was a graph. It was a line on a chart. And we would talk to people about the parts per million that are going up.
It's kind of theoretical.
Yeah, it was theoretical. It was an intellectual exercise, and we were correct. But it was not visceral. Now this is a visceral loss. It's people standing in trying to stand in 8 feet of water in Hamburg, Iowa.
Well, you saw this in Paradise, right?
This in Paradise. I saw this in Seminole Springs. I remember talking to Marsha Moss in Seminole Springs. This is a group of mobile homes burnt out in a small, beautiful little community north of L.A. And she was just telling me about showing me her home and the devastation that woman experienced was so visceral and profound. So now it is something people are experiencing in their own lives. They're seeing it and they're living it. And so this is no longer an abstraction. So the country's ready. This is a magic moment where you have a twinning of urgency. This is the last chance. This is the last chance. We will not have another opportunity to save our grandchildren from this if we do not act in the next administration. Together with the enormous increase of clean energy jobs that are coming on, the number one fastest growing job is solar installer. And we can now, in my retrofitting requirement to retrofit buildings, we got, you know, thousands or hundreds of thousands of jobs for carpenters and laborers and plumbers and electrician. Everyone can participate in this revolution. So it is a magic moment. But look, it requires inspiration. We would not have gone to the moon without the President Kennedy calling us to that unified mission. And that's why I called my book Apollo's Fire, Igniting America's Clean Energy Economy. We need that spark. And I do believe this is something that is very deep in the American character. We are a can-do people. We are innovators. We invent, we create, we build. But we need that spark of innovation from the White House. And I think I've demonstrated over a decade of that inspirational quality.
President Trump came out to California after one of the wildfires, and he was standing there with Lieutenant Governor at the time, Gavin Newsom, and Governor Jerry Brown.
You mean in Pleasure Town, or I can't remember what he
called it. He misnamed Paradise. Right. And talking right there in the midst of the devastation about, you know, questioning the science. And what do you make of that? Because it's not just him, of course. There is strong opposition among Republicans. Is it as simple as, you know, you don't want to lose votes among your base, or that you're getting contributions from the fossil fuel industry, or is it something more than that?
Well, first off, for me to try to explain Donald Trump's cranial position is impossible for me to even give a hypothesis about.
But
I would point out that at least 75% of Americans now are asking us to take action on climate change. And this is moving very rapidly. It's had an 11-point swing towards reality in the last year. And certainly the Democratic side, this is now the number one priority in the Iowa primary voters, tied with health care. So people are now recognizing this. So yes, a lot of Republican politicians are more interested in being slavishly devoted to Donald Trump than they are being devoted either to science or the wishes of their constituents.
Well, I want to ask about kind of political strategy around climate change. I was covering the cap and trade negotiations in the California Capitol in 2017, and we saw Governor Jerry Brown really approach it from kind of a center left, I would argue, perspective. He wanted to get business on board. He wanted to get Republican votes on this big climate change legislation. There are people who have said that's not possible on a national level. You have to approach this from the left, something like the Green New Deal. I mean, how would you approach this as president politically?
Well, I'm going to be rolling out the beginning. We're going to have several tranches of my clean energy plan. And the first one we will roll out will be Friday in Los Angeles. And I'm looking forward to that. And what I will propose are policies that we know that work. Look, we're doing it in my state. And again, this comes back, there's a bit of a theme to my candidacy. This is not just rhetorical flourishes. Just come to my state and look what we've done. We're passing a 100% clean energy bill, the most vigorous in the nation. We will be the first nation to wean ourselves totally off of coal-based electricity in 2025. We are the first state that will require retrofits to our buildings to have less wastage. We are one of the most aggressive in electrifying our transportation system. These are things that we are actually doing and accomplishing. And I don't believe that those should or can be hung up in Congress if, one, we have a president who's been working on this for two decades, and two, we get rid of the filibuster. Now, this is important. This may sound like just a procedural issue, but it's life or death when it comes to climate change. And I was the first candidate who says we need to get rid of the filibuster so that we can advance clean energy legislation. And I believe it is possible to do that, in part because we've done it so successfully in my state.
Governor, we're almost out of time. Before we let you go, though, I know you have a reputation as being very funny.
Funny-looking, that's what you get.
What do you do for fun, especially now that you're running for president?
Well, I love riding my bicycle. I feel like I'm 10 years of age anytime I'm on my bike. It's kind of a time machine. I love playing with my grandkids, three who have been officially designated as the cutest, funnest grandchildren in the state of Washington. And I really do. I treasure those times. And anytime I'm with them, they came down, their Cub Scout troop came down to my office the other day, and it was just a joy to see what we're protecting and what we're fighting for. So these can be long days, 18-hour days on the trail, but thinking about them is a very high motivator to do this work.
All right. Governor Jay Inslee, thanks so much for joining us on
Thank
Political
you.
Breakdown.
Don't forget to vote.
And that does it for this edition of Political Breakdown, a production of KQED Public Radio. Special thanks this week to the Silicon Valley Community Foundation for hosting our interview with Governor Inslee.
Our engineers are Seal Muller and Rob Spate, and KQED's leadership team includes Holly Kernan, Ethan Lindsay, and Vinny Tong. I'm Guy Marzorati. You can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Guy Marzorati. And never fear, Lagos Hive. Marisa's back next
week. She will be back with a vengeance. I'm Scott Schaefer. You can follow me on Twitter as well. I'm at Scott Schaefer. That is a wrap for this week's Political Breakdown from KQED. We'll see you next time, everybody.
Hi there. I'm Randa Abdel-Fattah from Throughline. If you're listening to this podcast, you know that KQED produces exceptional storytelling that keeps you informed, inspired, and entertained. Their podcasts cover issues from your neighborhood to the entire country and everything in between. Support this work today.
You can help us continue to bring quality podcasts to your ears. Just head to donate.kqed.org/podcast. That's donate.kqed.org/podcast.